Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 468th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor, the director of practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also an adjunct professor at the University of Alberta.
And Mike, this is going to be a gooder podcast.
Yeah, it's gonna be gooder or goodest.
Yeah.
So this is I'll give a little background to this, and James knows some of it, and I know he's struggled over a lot of the similar things. But over the years, I've tried to kind of figure out where we kind of take missteps in our thinking, and the last few years. And as I did evidence-based medicine and tried to evaluate things like, you know, the enthusiasm for things like A1C and surrogate markers and all of that, that leads down this path. Then we've also tried to look at things that win awards in medicine for kind of funny or silly research or not even silly, but research that could be conceived as funny in what it found. And that led us down here a little bit more. And then the last 4 years, what's been happening in the world has left me scratching my head about a lot of things as well. And so through all that, I've kind of looked at what are logic missteps we do, mostly in medicine, but also we see it in life. So this is going to be a far-reaching podcast or series that's going to talk about things like conspiracy theories and different ways that we can get a little bit pulled away from the best thinking possible. And when James and I talk about this, it's going to sound like we're going to be these dispassionate people who can look at research and knowledge and never be biased. Oh. But we would fall into all of the same
traps. Absolutely, yeah. If you know, we have a bit of a filter that helps us a little bit, but it is so easy to go down that frickin' rabbit hole. Right?
And all of the rabbit holes. We're going to really hit on three primary cognitive errors that we can make. Yeah. And we're going to spend some time on those. But we're going to lay some groundwork in how we have to, and how we have to think about them and why we think about them these ways. And we'll spend a bit of time figuring out what kind of ways forward is there.
Yeah,
and we've talked a lot about this. Yeah,
I was going to say I like the the title is sort of misinterpretation and misdirection, and that sort of encompasses many of the issues that we've seen in medicine. Well, since I was in practice, although I'm no longer in practice, but you've seen the same thing, and certainly since we've been doing this podcast.
Right, and most things are done, there probably is someone, but most of the mistakes and most of the ways we get led astray, it isn't someone sinister sitting in a basement somewhere, kind of, you know, like Mr. Burns having his fingers touching together and kind of, you know, wiggling them and pondering about how he can destroy the universe and that kind of thing. There's nothing nearly that sinister. Many of them are founded in a hope to get to a healthier place for everyone. And that can mean, again, in the medicine sense or even the broader sense. But it's certainly, and we're not experts in this area, but we've read a little bit of literature around it. And that will lead us to point out to you that when we do this presentation, we are in fact falling into one of the three areas.
And when you say there's no, you know, there's not necessarily an agenda or, you know, a criminal intent, there is a small percentage that is. And that's that's the tricky part. I would say the vast majority is not, but there is that small percentage, and it's tricky to identify that. And so, you know, I think both you and I are, believe it or not, even I don't know if the audience believes this, we're both marginally optimistic. And
I don't think anyone would ever have suggested
yeah,
that.
Yeah, no, we are. I mean, yeah. But anyway, so why don't you start working us through like the I guess sort of the what you've sort of entitled the logic missteps in medicine, I guess.
Yeah, so the logic missteps. I think there are three main ones, but we're going to talk about other things. I am going to have you delve into, or we're going to delve into the conspiracy theory stuff mm-hmm. early on, just so we can kind of get it out of the way. But there are three missteps. Actually, let's do the conspiracy stuff first, mm-hmm. and then we'll get to that. Sure. So the conspiracy stuff, when you look at that, about, you know, this, most of this research is done in the US, and it's not meant to run them down, because I think that it would be the same in Canada. It's just, we have 1/10 the population mm-hmm. and therefore get researched about a tenth as much. Yeah. But what these guys did, this was a study published in the American Journal of Political Science back in 2014. And they asked, they did a survey where they asked people in the US, do you believe in one of seven conspiracy theories? And there were all sorts, like the birther theory, the mm-hmm. truther theory, and the truther is around the 9/11 stuff, that it was a conspiracy. Right. The yeah. financial crisis was all orchestrated by Wall Street, etc. But 55% of Americans believed at least one of the seven. Mm-hmm. So recognize that, you know, if you're on a podcast with two people, one of those two people believes in at least one conspiracy theory.
Yeah,
and James, and you, by the way.
No. I my theory is it's you, but that's a conspiracy theory, so it's tricky.
That is the conspiracy theory.
Yeah. Believe it or not, we've just sort of shown one of the issues around all of this is, that other people are way more likely to believe in stuff than I am. That sort of mantra.
Or like get led down the garden path. But yeah. the conspiracy theory that I believe in is the right one.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And so that's the same as the drug industry. And we've seen that research, James. I know you've seen it, where I don't believe that I'm influenced by the drug industry, but I know that almost everyone else is.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And that cognitive error will be one of the ones we address as well.
Yeah, yeah.
In our cognitive errors. But I think it's a couple of the things that come out of these is this source that there's a belief that a conspiracy theory has some kind of unseen, intentional, malevolent thing behind mm-hmm. it. Mm-hmm. So when people believe in them, they often have associated some deep kind of state that's is out to get them. And the people who can more likely fall prey to that really have grandized, put in high importance, the kind of good versus evil mm-hmm. in the world.
And you can see where, I mean, we do have, you know, historical examples of this actually happening. And then if you just look at whether you even go social media, or if you look at what we watch on TV as far as films and everything and movies and all that sort of stuff, like a movie that doesn't have that in it is not usually very good.
It's not very exciting. We need some of that.
Yeah. So
some deep state stuff. And that's going to be the very first one that we review the logic missteps. It's the power of the narrative.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. When a narrative is given, it has so much power that we can get fooled by that. And we're going to spend a lot of time.
Yeah, exactly.
On that. And some of the important characteristics that the last piece is that each side believes that the other. So if I'm a believer in a conspiracy theory, I believe that those who don't believe it are under a ruse. They're being tricked.
Yeah.
And those who don't believe it believe that the other group is completely kind of deceived or under a ruse. Mm-hmm. So it's these fascinating kind of good versus evil, that there's some malevolent force doing this bad stuff and this adversarial nature to things that you want to be on the right side of it.
Yeah.
And that's what draws them.
Yeah, no, exactly.
And so if you look at narratives that that really did captivate this, so the fake news issue that came up, we saw that, you know, what you're hearing from me is real and honest, but everyone else who disagrees with me is fake. And that, on the face of it, what I just said feels so absurd, but actually it had a good story, that you had someone telling you something you can finally believe, and that all you need to do for the things that don't believe what you believe, they can just be dismissed. And that, again, is one of our cognitive errors. We have to believe what we want to believe, right?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And then the next piece of I think, that's relevant to some of this conspiracy theory, and it's more just about conspiracy theories, about the type of people who are drawn to them. And there's lots of research that is conflictory, like the idea that cynics are more likely to, right-wing people are more likely to.
Yeah.
But one of the things that has been relatively well looked at is the idea of finding patterns in something. So you've probably heard people say, and you probably heard it about hockey, James, that when one of your teammates is doing well that day, you kind of want to pass him the puck because you think he's probably going to get a better chance at a goal. And there's something in basketball called the hot hand, and the idea that let's give it to so-and-so because they're going to sink it more.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when they actually looked at the episodes where people had a run of baskets, it wasn't out of
just check the chance by chance.
Yeah. And if you think about it, if I have a coin and I flip it 1,000 times, it's quite likely that I'm going to get 8-9 heads in a row at one point.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so that's it. And then
when you see them in isolation, that's where we can't ignore it.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Is that you can't, and but you're right. The sports analogy is a good one. Like the you know, clearly you need skill, but every time, you know, if you score, or if you shoot a basket and you make 1 out of 3 shots, or if you're playing a sport and you shoot and you score 1 goal out of 15 shots, that one goal was some luck associated with it, in that a whole bunch of things had to come into place for it to work. You couldn't just do it by skill. You know what I mean? Yeah. And there was a whole bunch of things that had to fall into place. And when those things fall into place randomly, you can get these streaks.
And you think that there's something to them. Yeah. You sense a pattern.
Yeah. Now the only thing I would add to that, though, is there is something to be said for confidence. Confidence.
Yeah, in sport. And I've had that and I've not had it. And
yeah. And so, we realize all of those things, but there is a lot of chance with a lot of these things.
Right. And so if you're like me and you have elements that you think sometimes are super, like where I wouldn't say I'm superstitious, but where you could, I certainly grew up in that kind of, to a small scale, that kind of family. So you think, you know, yesterday you had a fabulous day and what you wore were jeans. So maybe if you wore jeans again, and that happens in sports again all the time, right?
There's so many superstitions, putting on your skate, you know, left foot first, or, you know, doing this or taking this many swings with a golf club. And oh yeah. And
absolutely. Before you swing, you're totally right. So you might think, you have to be super smart to kind of, you have to be at least a human to fall prey to that. Well, they've actually studied pigeons. And what they found is that if you feed pigeons at kind of a pattern time, they will try and repeat the behavior that they were doing just before they were fed. Because they think that somehow what they were doing, let's say they were pecking in a corner of the cage, that somehow resulted in the food coming out. So if they're hungry, they'll run to the corner and peck there. So it's not just us. It boils all the way down to something as high level as a pigeon who tries to draw connections.
Yeah. And it's because, I mean, to tell you the truth, because sometimes these connections keep you alive.
Sometimes they do.
Like when you go, oh, you know, I 12 times I was by that snake, I got bitten every time. Maybe I shouldn't do it. You know, If assuming you survived the first 12 bites.
Ten or twelve bites.
Yeah.
So what they've done is they've tested people who see patterns in things or are more likely to see patterns in things. And what they found with those, and they did it with random coins, they did it with art that was randomly done versus symmetrical shapes and all sorts of things. And what they found is that people who see patterns in things are more likely to believe in conspiracies, make connections,
right.
And that kind of thing. And that, again, is kind of stuff we'll be talking about as we go along. Yeah. So let's get into the main body of our talk. I just think it's so fascinating in a world where we're seeing so much conspiracy, whether it's the things we've seen happen around the U.S. election, whether it's COVID deniers, masks are mind control devices.
Vaccines and
vaccines now. That's where, exactly where I was going. Thanks.
And so, we'll get into it a little bit, but I'm not going to start now. Don't even get me started on nutrition. And we'll go. Yeah. That's a whole other.
Magic properties, right? Like we've joked about me being asked by patients, like, you know, I have knee osteoarthritis. Should I eat more potatoes or noodles for my starch? Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. So the logic missteps, the three that I think are probably you can draw some relevance from for much of medicine are the overriding power of a good narrative.
Yeah.
And you hear this in politics as well, expanding it again, is that there, you know, when something goes wrong, the politicians, the bureaucrats, everybody, they're creating their narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, and we're going to spend a lot of time on, really where that comes from. Or where we can find the best example of it, I think, for us when we really start to understand how that can be a distraction.
Yeah, and I know when you knew we were going to put this podcast together, I mean, do you want to go over a couple of just a quick couple of examples or?
Well, let's do the three and then we'll get back
okay.
in there.
Yeah.
So the next key one is opinions are like concrete. Once they've been molded, you cannot shape them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's actual research on that. There's all sorts of stories and philosophers who've talked about it, but actually there is research showing that it is incredibly easy to instill a strong belief in people that cannot be refuted with facts.
Yeah, yeah.
And the last thing is that our confidence is highest and best when we are at our most ignorant.
If you know nothing about something.
Yeah, if you know virtually nothing, that's when you're all set to be a leader of the world.
Yeah.
because the less you know, the more confident you are.
Yeah.
So those three we're going to spend a lot of time on and kind of talk about what's the research around them, how can we think about them. And to me, I see it percolating in so much of what we do. So let me give you an example. And I don't know, is this the one you were going to talk about, James?
No, I've got a few of my own, but no, go ahead.
Okay, so this was from the news, and it was from the CBC, which is a Canadian, our national Canadian news network. Yeah. And they asked the question, and this was from 2020, September, can Reiki, or is it Reiki or Reiki?
I think it's Reiki, but I honestly don't know, and I don't really care.
Can Reiki be a legitimate treatment if no one can prove how it works? Now, this to me, and James, you'll know, because the content I sent you, I accompanied this clipping with a picture of an electron microscope. Because that is the tool you would need to find out how much I care about how Reiki works or Reiki works. I don't, the question is not how it works.
Yeah.
That's the narrative. That's the distraction.
Yeah.
What you need to know is, does it work?
Yeah. I mean, and you could have thrown homeopathy in there.
You could literally throw anything.
Yeah.
Can olive oil be a legitimate treatment if we don't know how, whatever.
Yeah.
It really doesn't matter because the sentence in itself is nonsensical and it shows how we get distracted. Imagine if Reiki or Reiki or whatever, if it worked like a hot damn. Would you, like, if it cured all lung cancers with two treatments, absolutely cured them, and I know we're so far
down the folklore narrative,
but imagine if it did. Would you care how it works?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's...
It'd be interesting.
Yeah.
And as my friend says about political decision making, the facts, well, interesting, are irrelevant.
Yeah, yeah.
but this is an example of how we've lost our way.
Yeah. And like the example is, I don't really understand how electricity or computers really work. I guess someone maybe does, but I think they do.
Yeah, you believe in them.
Yeah.
Someone has to know what they do.
Yes.
Yeah. Otherwise, they've just been created.
Yeah, exactly.
De novo. Yeah. I'm going to give you a second example of one that made me scratch my head. And this was, again, in medicine. And I think it speaks to all kinds of wrong, how we've been distracted. So this was from New England Journal's Journal Watch. And the editorial read, "Sulfonylureas for patients with type 2 diabetes, still an option." That's the title.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't care what the title is, but it did make me wonder, because the evidence isn't great.
Yeah.
So I read the article, and it basically was two points that are in their favor. They lower glucose cheaply, and they probably do not increase cardiovascular disease.
Yeah. But if you were to say that to a person who knows, doesn't really get what we're talking about, they'd go, "Oh, that's good."
Yeah, that is good,
right?
Isn't that wonderful? It does absolutely nothing, but it's inexpensive.
But it's not that it doesn't do it. It lowers glucose though,
That's the narrative.
Yeah, but if you haven't made the think that the only reason you lower glucose is to reduce cardiovascular disease, or one of the almost the main reason, you wouldn't pick up the nuance of how stupid that is.
Yeah, and so this is the thinking pieces that we've got lost on. So James just hit the nail on the head. So the first one is the narrative, the story around glucose and how it lowers. If it's higher, it has bad outcomes, and therefore we need to lower it. The next thing is that this person has fallen for that narrative. They're an endocrinologist, and it's a piece of who they are now. Mm. And they believe in it like they believe in gravity. So their opinion about it is now concrete.
Yeah.
So there's no wavering it. And then when they bring that out to the masses, their patients only have heard that tidbit of information that glucose is bad.
Mm-hmm.
So to them, they've got so little information that they're confident enough to go by with that next piece. And so these kind of things are how we're falling prey to making missteps in how we interpret information. Sulfonylureas, the title should have read "Sulfonylureas for patients with type 2 diabetes." What the hell were we thinking?
Yeah, no, I agree. And the one and the one word that you haven't even talked about is cheaply. Because cheaply drives the narrative as well. Because, oh, isn't it good?
Yeah, it's inexpensive.
Yeah.
I'm saving money.
Yeah, but you know, something that doesn't work, whether it's cheap or expensive, it still doesn't work.
Imagine buying a car. You get it for 1/10 of the price of a normal car. But you can never drive it. It never can take you anywhere you need to go.
Yeah.
Are you saving money? Like it's still not helpful.
Yeah.
So those are the two that kind of got me thinking about this whole thing, and got me thinking about how we think in the world, how I think. And don't get me wrong, as I said right from the start, James and I have made, I'm sure, some of these errors, and we'll talk about that, particularly with the, you just need a little information.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think just some very quick examples of where on the face of it, I sort of bought into them originally, like before I did a lot of this sort of stuff. I mean, just think about the diet heart hypothesis.
Yes.
You know, you eat fat.
Yeah.
Your cholesterol, it has something to do with your cholesterol. We know cholesterol in some people is associated with heart disease, and therefore lowering fat will decrease heart disease. It's a beautiful story, but it's primarily bullshit.
Before I got into all this, I had trained myself to enjoy margarine over butter.
Oh, me too. And yeah, I was the same way. I was promoting, you know, low fat cream for coffee. What a nightmare.
There are probably things that are more of a nightmare. I can think of them.
No, I'm just, but you know what I'm saying. I used to, you know, religiously do aminoglycoside levels until I looked at the evidence and went, wow, what a waste of time that is.
Oh, yeah. I used to teach, measure your A1, measure your sugars at home. You're a brand new diabetic. Won't it be great for you to know? And I remember being sold on the COX-2 inhibitors. They're better. Oh, yeah. They're safer.
Yeah. How about this one? Beta-1 versus beta-2 selective. I mean, it's a great narrative because you can build you can take a snippet of maybe mechanism of action information and go there. And I know we're going to talk a little bit about antioxidants, but then, you know, what about all the different antidepressants and all the different receptors? Like the SSRIs, the SSNRIs, the NRIs, the TCAs, and the MOA inhibitors. And for all intents and purposes, they're not that much different.
No, and I love the fact that, well, and in fact, once you start to use them for other things, they generate, like many of the antipsychotics are now found to work okay for depression and anxiety.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's like, and I always laugh in psychiatry when we would spend so much time teasing out the subtypes of depression and all this stuff, but in the end, it doesn't even matter whether they're anxious or depressed. We're going to give them an SSRI.
Yeah, like we're giving them
exact day medicine.
I know.
Why are we spending our time? It just seemed a mystery to me.
Like you said, the newer the better. And, I mean, how about this one, and I couldn't forget, you know, you've probably heard that you're not supposed to drink when taking antibiotics.
Drink alcohol.
Yeah, you're not supposed to drink.
Isn't it because you don't want to forget because you're drunk? They're afraid you'll be drunk and forget to take your antibiotics on time or something.
No,
is that when the birth control pill? I can't remember.
No, that maybe, but it's a brilliant story. But it's not the best of my understanding. Where this came from was when a lot of people were getting antibiotics for sexually transmitted diseases. What they realize.
No, this is the story. You're totally right. Yeah.
Because if you drink a lot, you are more likely to, you know, pull down your garden and have more sex. And so what they wanted to do is make sure that
it lowers down your inhibitions and makes you more. And there's actual research on that.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's why we were told not to drink when taking antibiotic. It has nothing to do with it. Won't the because here's the stories I've heard. Well, it makes the antibiotic not work. No, that's not true. You know, there's the metronidazole where you maybe, but even the metronidazole and the disulfiram type reaction is not 1,000% a myth, but it's not.
My understanding is it doesn't affect every patient.
Oh, right? It definitely doesn't affect every patient. And you know, there's no doubt there's a percentage of people where it does, but it's the whole thing is just really interesting. And, you know, anticholinergics dry up secretions and I guess they do sometimes, but whether
guafenazine, we added guafenazine to this.
Guafenazine and there's so many, but those are just some examples. And those are some of almost every one of those I at one point recommended.
And probably there'll be more of these that you're going to be recommending advising on. So, you know, the last one, the sulfonylurea one that I had spoken of, that one got me thinking about diabetes. And I thought, if when I'm thinking about diabetes, I'm feeling as I progress through this, that I'm thinking differently, because many people are probably imagining things like glucose monitoring, drugs for metformin, the harms like amputation, etc. But when I think about diabetes, for the most part, what comes to mind is magic shows.
Go on.
And I know you're thinking of me like, what in God's name, how did he get there? So let's actually, we'll deal with this, James. And then I think, you know, we'll see how much further we go.
Yeah, no, but once we get there, we'll stop and then we'll go on to the next one. Podcast.
I hope many of you know the two people named Penn and Teller, but they are both they have they are magicians, but they have a shtick, an angle that I think is really interesting, in that they tell you how magic is done.
Yeah, sometimes, not all, but they have examples where they do that.
Yeah, and they actually, if you're keen on that kind of thing, you can go to just search them up on YouTube, and they have all sorts of kind of how magic is done, yeah, or how did you get fooled with this illusion. And they have a show called Fool Us. I think you're the one that pointed it out to me, Jim. Yeah. And in Fool Us, what you do is you come on the show, and you are a magician as well, and you give your magic, and the hope is that you can do it without pen or teller figuring out the trick of how you pulled it off. But their goal is to try and, you know, figure out how you did it and then and take that away from you in a sense.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're on there in all good spirits about it. And if you do fool them and they can't figure out how you pulled the trick, then they give you the FU award.
Which I know is such brilliant. The abbreviation FU.
Yeah. So it's called the FU award. And I really do recommend if you're interested in any of this to tune into them, because it's actually, and I'm going to steal from one of their lessons. Mm-hmm. And the lesson is Penn and Teller give a lesson in misdirection using a vanishing chicken. And in that, they talk about what it is that they're doing with magic a lot of the time. And so they talk about misdirection, which I think is the key. The way lay people use misdirection is wrong. They use it as a synonym for distraction. But that is not the way they see misdirection. They see it as the curating of attention. Mm-hmm. Drawing your attention in with a story, with a show that allows you to kind of forget about the fact that right now magic is happening, that you should be paying attention to if you want to peek behind the curtain, as it will.
Yeah, yeah.
So they say in it, it's about giving the audience a story to tell themselves that lets them not really know that they were distracted, but allows them to be comfortable with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there are times that we tell ourselves stories in medicine, and we're focusing on medicine, but it's actually for a lot of things, that we tell ourselves a story that actually allows us to drop our guard and not really even think about peeking behind the curtain.
Yeah. And what I find fascinating with that show is that, and they're not the only magicians to do this, but even once they've shown you how to do it, like if you're watching it face on, but then if you were watching it from the other side, you could see how they do it. But then even once you know it, and then they do it, they could do it again in front of you, and you still go, wow,
you know, that's cool.
Even though you already exactly know how they did it, and you go,
so that's the two things. That's the narrative. And that is because you've already bought into it the first time. Your belief around it, your feelings about it are fixed.
Mm-hmm.
They're fixed now. So even when we give you the facts, you don't care as much about them as you do about the feelings.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no,
that's part two, but it is, they're all wrapped up together.
And none of this is exclusive to magic or medicine or politics. It's life.
Yes, there's all sorts of stories about, so take chairs, for instance, all of that ergonomic stuff that chairs are supposed to, like, I do not think there's a lot of solid research on that. The last time I looked, it wasn't great.
Yeah, no, I agree.
But,
the how do you know if a chair is going to be comfortable? Sit in it.
For a while.
Yeah, 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 yeah. No, yeah, can't, yeah, if you do it for a minute, that's not going to work. But yeah, yeah, no, exactly. And, you know, it's almost like, it's a great example, because it's like, you know, the same thing to do with medications. You don't know what they're going to do. until you actually try it.
So, yeah, it's things like chairs and diets and all of these things that we think we there's a lot of stories around why they might work. Certain exercises are better for this. Like I've heard this one's more fat burning. This one's more sugar burning.
Oh, God.
You know, it's crazy stuff. So what we're going to do in the next episode is we're going to take you through. Now we've built the idea of how the distraction that's occurring is a lot like a magic show when we talk about our narratives. And what we're going to do in the next one is we're going to spend a lot of time talking about the narratives in medicine. And we're going to give you lots of examples of narratives and how powerful they are, and how even when the narratives change, or how when the evidence change, we just flip the narrative. And how easy that is for us. And so we'll talk about how reliable these narratives really are.
Yeah. Excellent. So anything else you want to bring up, Mike, or you're good?
No, I think that's everything, James. Thanks.
Okay, good. So I think we'll just leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening, and hopefully you'll listen next time to the exciting part two of this podcast.
Talk to you later.